Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the blabbernacle. I got a quick little podcast to sneak in here. I know it's not Saturday. I hope nobody gets upset about that. But we just got back from Sunstone, and while we were there after the conference, which was mostly held on Saturday, there was a little bit before and after, but mostly Saturday, Saturday night in the hotel room, Thomas Hatton, Benjamin Knoll, and myself kind of recapped the Sunstone experience. And so that's what you're getting today, about 55 minutes of chatter about what this regional Sunstone conference was like. So that's really all the intro you're going to get. Let's jump right to it. All right, so we're going to do a Sunstone recap. We all are here at Sunstone Kirtland. Last night there was a vigil. We'll talk about that. Today there was the conference starting at 10 with a tour of the Kirtland Temple. And tomorrow there will be a sermon by Jana Reese and then one more lecture on the history of women's healings. So we won't be able to summarize those because we'll be getting on the road and getting out of here. But we'll summarize the rest, we'll recap, we'll tell you what we did, what we liked, what we hated. Especially the hate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess let's start with Friday. We got here, so this will be mostly our personal experience. We're not doing like a journalistic reporting of Sunstone. So we get here, and the drive, you guys drove a couple hours, then got me, and we got up here, and then it started hailing, and we're supposed to meet at this tavern. So I think God was telling us.
Yeah, we kept on joking. Tavern. Gosh, we really should turn around.
God let's just go back.
God is crying icy tears
this
upon
is a clear
us.
Sign we've done the wrong thing, going to a tavern. But anyway, we got there, and as an introvert, I'm like petrified because there's all these faces, like John Hamer, Lindsay Park, Michael Ferguson.
And it turns out on the end of the table, there were three empty seats, and then there was a... D. Michael Quinn, or as we know him now, Mike. Quinn. He's Mike to
just
us.
Just call me Mike.
Yeah. And so it's kind of a cool person to sit next to when you first get there because you're sitting next to the receptacle of church history knowledge for the last however long. So.
Yeah. Turns out he's a really super nice guy.
Yeah. Really pleasant guy and great conversation. And
anyone who says he's a weenie is lying because he's not. And he told us a lot. We talked a fair amount about his book that's coming out in February next year.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Church Finance.
Church Finances. Yeah.
So
we asked him for a sneak preview, any highlights from that, because I was really curious.
Yeah, and he said he's got, like, really detailed, granular data year by year through the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. And then it kind of gets a little more harder to get, I guess, for the 20th century. So.
A little preview.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Dinner was good. I got the pot roast.
Yep, I think Ben and I were burgers, mm-hmm. burger getters.
Yep. Traditional.
They were 5 out of 10.
Solid.
It was a tavern.
B,
so it's tavern.
Maybe B plus.
And you got the burger that was supposed to be like award-winning.
Yeah.
Braga burger.
Yeah, it was an award-winning burger, but the award may have not been super credible, or because it kind of tasted like the kind of thing you get at Sam's Club and you warm up in your George Foreman grill.
Yeah. So that was cool. And then they had it was a vigil for LGBT.
Human rights,
inclusivity. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. So it was in the temple. It took us a while to figure that out. You have to go through the visitor center and then get to the temple, and the door was locked, so we had to get the guy, he came and unlocked it for us.
And we were also, should we mention, we were rolling with our new friend Mike.
Yeah. And he's like, last time I was here, the other time I was here, you just went right in the front. And so we started walking around to the back, and
this guy, what's his name? Ron?
It was Ron.
Ron. Yeah. Yeah. Really, really nice guy.
Ron, who, he's the director of the visitor center?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's like, no, you can't get in that way.
Yeah.
Ooh. There's no doors.
We have to mention, when Brother Quinn was talking about going to the temple, he said, well, I guess I should head over to the temple.
Or I'll see you in the temple.
I'll see you in the temple. Yeah. And he said, it's been a... I've wanted to say that for a long time.
Yeah, he said it's been 30 years since I could say that.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of chuckled, and it's like, did we just laugh because it was funny? Because it was? Or are we relieving tension that this wonderful man's been excommunicated and all that? So that was kind of fun. So we got there. So we thought it'd be like a half hour. And it, what was it, like an hour and a half?
Yeah.
A lot of speakers. Nobody used Webster's to begin their sermon. So it's definitely not a Mormon or LDS sermon. They were like impassioned preaching was how I would describe it.
It was very moving.
Yeah.
And also, there were little tinges of familiarity. We sang Spirit of God, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there was also like, there were flatted and sharp notes in the hymn book that made me like have to second guess.
And they played it at a faster pace, and
the third verse too was revised, but the lyrics were a little bit different.
They changed the lyrics to be more inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of him, when it was referring to God, if I remember right, it's them.
Mm.
A lot of stuff like that.
And it said like Brigham Young's a jerk or something like that. Yeah.
FYI, nobody said Brigham Young was a jerk. The Community of Christ folks were exceedingly nice.
So that was really good. And then that was it for the Sunstone thing.
Well, they also there was a bell next to the podium, and they would ring the bell.
Like the meditation bell.
So I was like,
it was like a cowbell.
I would love to have that.
Zen bell.
Yeah. I was just thinking I would love to have that next to the podium at church. I think it was a nice closer.
It was a calming effect, yeah.
Oh, yes.
That was nice. Yeah.
So that was good, and then we ate more food, and then we went to sleep, and then we woke up.
Yeah.
And then we put clothes on.
Yeah.
No, then we went back, and the first thing today was a tour of the temple, Kirtland Temple, at 10 o'clock. And we were... They have, like, it's a nice visitor center, and we have, like, a 20-minute video, and the video was different than
typical
visitor center, because it was, like, something, you know, a History Channel thing, but not crappy aliens History Channel. Like, they were telling the story
Adolf Hitler,
of the rest.
No secret Bible.
The secrets of the Masons. Something like that. No, they were telling the story of the restoration, basically, and mostly of the Kirtland Temple, but they situated it within the context of the time. They talked about all these other people that had similar restorationist impulses and that sort of thing, and you wouldn't ever expect that at, you know, the Nauvoo LDS Visitor Center, for instance.
And I really like that the focus of the restoration movement, they focused on the communal economic united orders that were popping up all over the country, and the focus on taking care of each other and caring for the poor, and all of these economic experiments were with the objective of trying to alleviate suffering and poverty. So that was how the whole thing was introduced before they even started talking about a temple, so I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, the purpose behind or building up to the worship place. And it's really, I mean, it's still a big building.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a small building. And I was just imagining, and later in a presentation, John Hamber showed a juxtaposition of a normal-sized church compared to the temple. Like, they were crazy ambitious building that thing.
Especially, you know, for the time, yeah.
And how impoverished the early members were. Then we had a long Q&A session with an apostle of the RLDS, or the Community of Christ. And that was
cool. His last name was Mackey, and his first name started with an L.
Lachlan Mackey.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice guy, and a historian as well.
Is that what he was? I mean, he knew his history for sure.
Mm-hmm.
He was a resident historian.
I'd
have to check his
actual
if he has academic training, but he's sort of like the visitor. He was the manager of that area, so he was Ron's boss.
And you can imagine the Sunstone crowd. They all are very respectful, but they have real historical questions, and he was able to answer them really straightforwardly, and it wasn't all just, no, you don't need to worry about that polygamy stuff. Like, he talked about that openly.
It was really refreshing, because
yeah.
the same sort of things that you grapple with in any faith, and specifically the LDS faith, he was, you know, he was saying he has conflicts about LDS history, and even our LDS history, which, it's just, I don't know. There was a sense of solidarity, at least, in that
yeah.
part.
Like, and real yeah. engagement with it, not deflection or anything like that. So that was cool. Then we all walked over to the temple, and they have to split you into groups, because we went all the way up to the top floor, which is basically an attic, but that's where the headquarters of the church were eventually, at least for a time. And that's where they had... Would that be the first School of the Prophets, or was it not called School of the Prophets at that point? Well, that might have been,
that
just
may have been
a
the Whitney store.
Oh,
but right. they did have the School of the Prophets. They said it was the school of something
there was
else.
Some school,
but it's where they took the first.
Students?
Well, the, they had the Joshua Satius lessons,
mm-hmm.
uh-huh.
Hebrew,
Hebrew
lessons,
yeah.
the Hebrew
yep.
lessons.
That's right.
And so they had. They wanted to teach them Hebrew, and they talked about the dedication of the temple and the. Endowment ceremonies that led up to it, which are profoundly different.
Cinnamon whiskey, foot bathing, right?
Yeah.
Foot anoint,
was body that was, body bathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I asked if there was some sort of ritualistic text like our modern endowment, and they said there may have been things they said, but it was some sort of endowment process that involved the washing with cinnamon whiskey.
Yeah.
Which, and what was the other thing he said?
And that's mentioned in Greg Prince's book as well. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Like, they would stand in tubs to collect it, so it wouldn't
yeah.
just...
Yeah, so is that in foot washing? And some, like, the equivalent of anointings, basically. But not
so.
Not as sophisticated, or not... It didn't sound like it was as complicated as the current LDS anointing ritual is.
Yeah. A little shorter.
Yeah.
Did you guys talk about the mummies upstairs?
No.
Really.
So, I've been to Kirtland twice, and I've never been upstairs. So this is my third time. This is the first time I've been upstairs. So when you go through, there are some old relics, and then
the third level.
In the, yeah,
clarifying.
In the third, this is the top level of the temple. It's smaller, and there are probably three subdivided room type settings.
Three
they're
or four.
Open rooms, but
yeah.
they're partitioned out. And then at the very last one, there's a bookcase and then some books. That's where Hebrew was taught. And then there were two doors over on the sides, and people were asking different questions. And I was looking at the doors, and I said, "Hey." What are these doors for? And they said, oh, well, they needed to use up the space, so they added the storage. But for a time, when the church had acquired those mummies...
From Chandler,
they had put them in there.
Oh,
and so a lot of people who traveled and visited...
Didn't hear that.
No, I didn't
hear
that, yeah.
They really liked the mummies. And so, of course, I was like, well, you should bring the mummies back. That'd be a cool little, you know, end note, you know, like, and look what's in here. Anyway, I thought that was kind of a funny little tidbit, was the mummy bit. I'm like, you really should add that into your presentation.
But it was cool to the temple's divided up into three levels, and the top one is like the headquarters, an early classroom before it was completely finished. The second level is the education learning level, and the benches there, they had these tables that you could flip up to take notes or whatever, and so it's clear that that's certainly what that was for, with the four-tiered podiums on each side.
The bucket pulpits, like they have on the main level. It's
yeah.
just a little bit smaller.
And all of these...
not as elevated.
Both the second and the first level, the pews that you sit on, you're inside a box. Like, you open a door to get into the pew, and then you close it behind you when you get in there. And you sit in there, and you're kind of in a box, which was mm-hmm. kind of strange.
I've been to some Anglican cathedrals in London,
yeah.
where it was a lot like that. The seating was... So it seemed like that was hearkening back to architectural styles they're probably familiar with
yeah.
from England or from Europe. Is my guess.
There were... How many windows did they make? Like, Brigham Young's thing, he made windows. Him and his brother were glazers. And they made, like, 65 of these big windows and, like, over 3,000 panes of glass or something like that. And
mm-hmm.
So it was pretty cool. And they had, like, a 1,000-pound bell that's up, that's still there, and they ring it every Sunday at 9 a.m., ring it 50 times.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a cool building. So that was the start, and then we went into the sessions.
Part two, the sessions.
Actually, we went and got lunch.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
So then the first session...
And the whoopers were good.
We were in this visitor center room. So imagine going to a Nauvoo visitor center or a visitor center in Salt Lake where you have one of these nice theaters and it filled with Sunstone people and Michael Quinn is talking about seer stones and magic and or a translation and that sort of thing. Because that's what it was. We're in the Community of Christ visitor center, and that was his topic.
And one of the neatest things, just so if you are trying to imagine the setting a little bit, when you're in the theater, there's a screen, and it's a projection screen, so you see a movie, and it's a beautiful little thing they do. They rise the screen up, and then you see through this pane of glass the Kirtland Temple, and
it's a window that's probably 30 feet wide, yeah. 15 huge. To 20 yeah. feet huge. Tall. Huge, big, open
we're talking
glass
like
window.
Enterprise view screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Bigger. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And they do it in such a way, and the floral arrangements and the trees, it just makes this very idyllic picture of the temple. Yeah. And so I believe, if I remember correctly, as they were talking, right, mm-hmm. wasn't that backdrop mm-hmm. the Kirtland Temple as well?
Yeah.
At least for some of it. So, you know, you had Brother Quinn and Maxine Hanks, and then...
John Nielsen?
Oh, yeah. John Nielsen. So
John Nielsen.
Yeah. John Nielsen is ex-FLDS, and so he gave some of the history of the FLDS group, how their change in perception or change in priesthood hierarchy and all that stuff came about throughout the 20th century for the most part. There's a little bit getting back into the 1890 where that shift started.
It was really it was interesting facts, and I kind of wish we were talking about. I wish he would have shared more about his experience in the FLDS, but you know it was his presentation to give. So
yeah.
I think that was kind of like an opportunity to learn a lot about that tradition.
Yeah, and Maxine Hanks was then after him.
Well, there were a couple of things with Michael Quinn.
Okay,
yeah, just real quick. So he talked about three different material objects that were used by early church leaders to receive revelations. He talked about Oliver Cowdery's divining rod and talked about the things with that. He talked about Joseph's now famous brown seer stone that has made all the internet
boil rage and wonder
for the last couple of months. This was new to me, though, what I didn't know. He said that stone that was used for the Book of Mormon was used only for the Book of Mormon, and then he gave it was it Oliver Cowdery?
He skipped it on a lake. I'm just kidding.
No, not true. So it was done. And then that wasn't used again. But then there was another seer stone, which he said was whitish, kind of gray. And that was the one used to receive the revelations for what became the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham and other blessings and revelations. And he said that stone is still in the church vaults but has not been shown to us. He said so there's still some things which is still behind the door that has not been made available to the public, and he hopes that someday that will change. We'll get to see a picture of that one too.
It just begs the question, like, we've seen one rock, I wonder why we didn't see the other rock.
Yeah,
maybe it's sort of building up the
one specifically. That came from the Joseph Smith Papers deal, the release of the Book of Mormon. Oh, by the way, sweet bookstore.
Yeah, really cool bookstore.
They've got signature stuff. They have some Coford stuff, Oxford University Press, their own. They had a whole shelf with John Whitmer Association, Dialogue, select printed volumes. Really cool stuff. You could spend a lot of money here.
Oh, for sure. So that was neat. And then when he finished up his talk, he had a quote that I really liked, in just talking about how do we understand church history, how do we deal with the world, and he said, both dogmatism and skepticism should remain modest, which I thought was a very profound way to engage with the world.
And that's how I live my life.
Yeah. And within the context of his presentation, you know, I actually had a conversation with my brother a while ago a similar topic because
about
we're
modesty.
It was about yeah. It was about wearing short shorts and
epistemic humility. That's what he's talking about. Epistemic humility.
Yeah. What we were talking about is just to not criticize or immediately invalidate something, not to approach it with like the automatic assumption that it's wrong or that it's false or
that it's right
yeah. or so. And I really like that. So my brother and I were talking, and he said, we look at those guys and we say what kind of stuff. They must have been out of touch or must have not known what's going on. But we live in such a synthetic world right now. Like, everything around us is artificial. Like, we have artificial heat controlling and temperature controlling. We spend, like, 10 hours a day. Like, we're so detached from actually the tangible physical world.
Yeah.
But it seems really funny, like, when we live in such an artificial bubble, that these people who, like, all they had were the world around them, that we can criticize them in really direct ways. Yeah. So, yeah, I like that approach. He wasn't saying that the stones didn't, because somebody said, well, did the stones work? And it was a Brother Quinn who said, you know,
there was one account where there was a lost item that he found, someone, not a treasure that he found, but a lost item, right? And then the only treasure that he actually found with the stone
was the
golden plates. The
golden plates. Yeah. They're like, well, and that was a pretty good one.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a cool presentation. And I guess that you could kind of lead into Maxine Hanks. She talked about a number of really cool things, sort of like the base of one of the coolest things about it. She talked about folk magic and different things like that, and how that really sort of set the stage for, you know, Joseph Smith's approach to religion. I thought it was a super enlightening look mm-hmm. into sort of the base of, you know, instead of just assuming that Joseph Smith was this anomaly in his family, learning that he came from like a family of visionaries, he came from a background of folk magic.
And she said, like, Lucy had a seer stone, right?
Yeah, Lucy had mm-hmm. a seer stone, mm-hmm. and she also was visionary. She would frequently have like really really intense and very, you know, she said her and another woman would get together. It was Porter Rockwell's mother? Is that what she said?
I didn't catch.
They would get together and they would share, they said on weekends, they would get together and they would share at nights their dreams and their visions. And
so, she was right, that's palm right. reading and did things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, she did palm reading and stuff.
That,
yeah.
So for Joseph growing up, both his mother and father regularly were reporting
yeah,
having visions.
She said that his dad has 9 or 11 recorded visions over a decade, between like 1809 and 1819 or something like that. And she pointed out that one of those is remarkably similar to the Tree of Life, Lehi's dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only visions I've ever had were when I was sick on my mission, so.
You're hallucinating.
And it was nothing cool, so I can't really.
And I like, too, that one of her connecting threads was the fact that in early America that women were just as charismatic, just as visionary, and just as well-versed and trained in the use of all of these magic worldview things as the men were, and she focused on all of the prominent women in Joseph Smith's life that influenced his the things that eventually happened with him there. And one of her key points is that we should, as a church, try to focus more on the narratives from visionary women in church history and the influence it had on the Prophet Joseph and others, which I thought was a cool thing to focus on.
And if you get a chance and you have the ability to read her paper or read about Sally Chase, I was just looking for that. Sally Chase was one of Joseph's competition. They were talking
right.
about that both of them were engaged in treasure seeking through seer stone usage and through visions, and that Sally Chase was this, you know, did she teach him how? Is what
she looked in her seer stone and saw that there was a seer stone underneath the tree trunk, underneath a tree roots or something, and he dug it out and found it. And that's mm-hmm. the story. And so they were kind of,
so there's a back and forth. Like,
her vision helped get his visionary beginnings.
But it made, if you get a chance or if you ever are curious, Sally Chase is the name, and it seems like there was some rivalry there between
yeah.
her and Joseph.
Then they split into groups. So these were like the big shots that were brought in, and there's also big shots later after dinner.
but then they split into concurrent sessions. So the session I went to was our wonderful friend Misha McGriggs, and her talk was titled Conflicts in Kirtland. And she kind of did a 10,000-foot view of some of the interesting stuff that happened in Kirtland. Some of her points were abolition, the Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company, the parish gang, and the apostasy, and there's one other thing, but I started getting our computer ready for our presentation. She brought up some quotes from Joseph and things about abolition, that we often think of him as being an abolitionist, and in 1835 he opposed abolition based on unfounded negative stereotypes of blacks, similar views as Brigham had. The Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company was they wanted to have a bank, but it was they couldn't get a charter passed, a legal charter passed, and some of the comments in the room suggested that this was not entirely uncommon, that developing a banking system, making a bank was there wasn't clear paths of how to make that happen and to get it supported and sanctioned by the state. So there was that, and the bank failed after 1 month, so that was not good. And there was this parish guy, can't remember his first name, that was the treasurer, and he apparently stole $25,000 of these anti-banking notes, which is kind of funny. Here's some money that's not legal anywhere, but I'm going to take it anyway. And he broke into the temple when services were going on and threatened members there with violence. And she said the police were called, so that means they literally called for police. You know, they didn't have a phone, and stopped the potential bloodbath. And about 10-15% of the membership left at that point over the
banks,
banking society. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of fun and interesting. And you guys went to a different session mm-hmm. at that point.
It was called "How to Start an Anti-Bank."
Oh.
No, just kidding.
No, it wasn't that.
That wasn't what it was. But I thought that was a funny term. I'd love there to be an anti-bank. We went to a really interesting discussion from a guy who's been published quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Christensen.
Kevin Christensen, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was entitled Joseph Smith and the First Temple Tradition. That was interesting. So his basic argument was that if you look at the history of Judaism and the temple theology, that there's First Temple Judaism and there's Second Temple Judaism, and First Temple is Solomon's Temple, and he cited a lot. He discussed the work of a scholar named Margaret Barker, who's written, a dozen books on all sorts of things in Christian theology and temple theology and all of this. And he talked about a lot of stuff real fast, but the basic of it is, as he said, that in the First Temple tradition, there were a number of doctrines that are very similar to Mormon doctrines that we have today. That when Josiah's reformations came around the time of the Babylonian exile and all that sort of stuff, that a number of those doctrines were selectively removed for the Second Temple tradition. And that then he noted that that's interesting, that when Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon comes along, they emphasize and have a lot of those things that were present in First Temple Judaism, but not in Second Temple Judaism. So he was presenting that as, these are some of the things that Joseph Smith restored as part of the Restoration, some of these doctrines that were present and then were lost. And then were
and back. Part of that was a real strong push for the feminine divinity. Mm-hmm. So, like, the Tree of Life is a representation of feminine divinity. And, you know, they talk about Nephi's vision that there's the Virgin Mary present. And mm-hmm.
Yep. And so he used, the Asherah tree poles that are present in the Old Testament as something that was in First Temple Judaism that were then removed. So if you link Asherah tree poles to the Tree of Life, and thus from the goddess Asherah to the Divine Feminine and Mother in Heaven, that's the argument that the doctrine of Mother in Heaven was removed and then restored.
Yes. And so Ben and I watched it, and we thought it was interesting, and we thought there were some interesting discussions on causality. But I will say, it was fascinating that what this guy did is he wrote a letter to Margaret Barker, who's a very credible, awarded scholar, and he said, "Hey, I just want to make you aware of some similarities, and between, you know, what you're talking about in your excellent scholarship, and you know what I'm, you know what we believe and what we're researching." And so she said, "I had no idea," in all caps, in her response back. And so this consummate scriptural scholar, he said she read the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price all in one day.
What? And she was that interested.
Yeah, she was that fascinated the connections. And then she came to BYU a few times, and I think she gave presentations in which she said, "Hey, I think it's really fascinating in your..." And she said, "I'm not a Mormon textual scholar, so I can't really say with any authority, but I can speak with my authority, or that I do see these very compelling parallels, and I see some familiar things that made for a really fascinating discussion." Mm-hmm. Whether it's the case, is the jury still out, but I do think that there was a lot of very compelling thoughts, and it definitely made us, you know, made us reconsider some of our perceptions of the Book of Mormon and its different concepts.
Well, and we were saying, as you guys talked about this earlier today with me, that it speaks well of Sunstone that this guy had a space here as well,
mm-hmm.
along aside, you know, the kind of the stereotypical views of Sunstone as being just a critical voice.
For sure, yeah, he was in the tradition of the Hugh Nibley kind of apologetic, finding the parallels between modern Mormon doctrine and ancient doctrines and religious practices, and using that to construct narratives there. So yeah, I thought that was a cool addition to have him there.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Yeah.
So then the next session was probably the highlight of the entire day. That was our session.
By far the highlight of the entire day.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would argue with that either.
No.
No, it actually went pretty well. I thought we had we had good reception. Presentation mostly went well. Thomas,
do you want me to tell the story?
Thomas, why don't just tell it? Relive your segment,
moment of shame.
The center of your segments.
So, I broke the HDMI cord, thus committing an unintentional terroristic act against the Community of Christ Church, and I didn't mean to. But I broke their HDMI cord, thus jeopardizing the efficacy of our presentation.
So what we had the... First of all, my computer would not connect to it, and so we had a little bit of a struggle trying to get our presentation onto this Community of Christ computer, because my computer apparently doesn't have any HDMI ports.
Yes.
So we had that, and then we got going, and they have... we're connected to a large flat-screen TV, and we're sitting in front of it, and so it's kind of an interesting. It was nice, but the cables are kind of dangling, and they're not really tight to the wall or tight to the floor.
And people were very deftly sort of sidestepping it or stepping over it their entire presentations because they were aware of it.
As I was watching Ben has these big figures, and he would stand up and point with his fingers and touch, like, on the screen, "Look at this, and then look at that, and you see this thing here," and then he would carefully step over the cord to get back to his speaking point. And Thomas, he doesn't give a crap.
No.
He's just going to step on any cord that gets in his way.
No, I did not see the cord, and I stepped on it, and it broke the HDMI cable. Yeah. Other than that, people said it didn't completely distract. People said it was good regardless, but that will be the thing I remember. They say when you die and you're in the celestial kingdom and you have that restored body, you remember everything you've ever done. I'll have to live with that for all eternity, that I ruined our presentation.
And
or I attempted to sabotage our presentation unintentionally.
So
it was like a Manchurian candidate thing, I'm sure. I mean, I was like conditioned to sabotage it.
So Thomas kept talking with, he kept going through with his presentation, and Brian Kissel was actually chairing, moderating whatever the role is, and so he went and talked to this Ron guy who's runs this show, and he's like, "We broke the cord. Do you have another one?" And he's like, "No, but I have one at my house." So he went to his house.
It was from his house.
Yeah, he went to his house, got an HDMI cable, brought it back, and I was doing mine, kind of using the computer screen as the presentation, and then like halfway through mine, they're like, "Oh, it's connected again. All right." Great. So we finished it.
Talk about magnifying his calling.
Seriously.
He went above and beyond
that. Yeah.
One of the coolest aspects, I think, of our presentation, as far as it wasn't necessarily our presentation, but I think the response to our presentation was a lot of really good discussion.
Yeah.
So people had a lot of questions. They thought it was a good conversation, and I think afterwards, we had a long Q&A.
Yeah,
was it
we
did. 30 minutes or so?
Yeah.
Like?
Yeah.
And people were, like, I don't know if they even got the last question. I think they said we have to stop. Like,
yeah.
People, because we were talking about online Mormonism, and is there a space for it? How do you help content from getting too hostile? How do you, like, keep content fresh and new, even though it's the same old stuff? So I think overall, like, there was a really cool discussion, which our presentation combined with, a really engaging discussion that sort of involved everyone in the room made for a really cool thing. And not to necessarily criticize, because I think the traditional setup for Sunstone is more presenting your scholarly information. We may have been a slight departure from that.
Yeah, we were more presenting our experience and
some research.
I don't know. Mine was based on academic research.
Yours was based on academic research. You cited some actual
we attempted to
social science, and I did too.
So. Yeah, we attempted to.
It wasn't just this is my thoughts, but it wasn't like deep history analysis, that kind of stuff. But it was fun.
Do the listeners care at all about the content of our presentations?
I recorded it, and so I'm going to do that on a separate deal.
I see. Very well, then.
Yeah. So, yeah, you'll get
we'll
to hear
it. Miss a minute. Yeah.
Afterwards, we just stood in the hall and yucked it up, and I just relived the stepping on the HDMI cord over and over again for another hour.
Yeah.
Which Mormons have guilt block complexes, so I genuflected.
And then that was it. Then we had, so we missed that session.
Yeah,
then we had dinner. We had John Hamer sit with us at our table, which was fun.
Yeah, that was
highly
great.
Enlightening.
Yeah.
That guy's, like we were saying, D. Michael Quinn is the receptacle of that type of knowledge. I think John Hamer probably knows more than anyone maybe on the earth about... I know, I'm serious. Wouldn't you say he's probably the most knowledgeable person about divisions among Mormon, you know?
Yeah, well,
I don't
know
that anybody else really studies that in depth, as in-depth as he does.
And he's
his co-editor on that volume might be well...
So he's, like, literally written a book on, like, the community press history and...
Well, the schisms of Mormonism. Yeah.
Yeah, he's written various books on different things, and so... He's
an
eminent scholar. He talked about James Strang and the Strangites, which made me want to go read the book of the Law of the Lord, and it made me want to go to Beaver Island and go to Boley County and meet all the people that are still practicing Strangites up in that area, still using the additional scripture revealed through James Strang.
But are they under the Community of Christ umbrella?
No, he was saying that a lot of people left to join the Community of Christ, and that there was a small contingency that stuck around, and they still are very committed and practicing. And then I guess that John Hamer has a good relationship with many of them, so he can visit the different ones, and he has rapport with them to, you know... He's not like, oh, you guys are a bunch of weirdos. He was talking about how cool and how pleasant the Strangites were and all that, so... Anyway, it was a cool dinner.
It was.
And then after dinner
was good too.
Dinner was good.
It was very tasty.
Lasagna.
And he spoke after that.
American.
And he had also had technical difficulties.
He had probably an excellent presentation, and the technical difficulties were 5 times worse than ours.
Yeah.
And nothing, he didn't step on anything.
The power went out, right?
The power went out.
Literally, yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Halfway through the presentation.
Power went out.
So the emergency power came on, but it only comes on for certain parts of the building and not the part that powers the screen. And
that was the root of it.
And then they brought in a flat screen TV so he could kind of present, because he said his presentation isn't really a verbal presentation, it's a visual one.
He made all these awesome charts and graphs and stuff.
And so they brought in this flat screen TV, and he was doing that, and then the power did kick on, and it automatically
welcome
starts
to the visitor center.
Audio presentation. Welcome to the visitor center.
It was playing like the Spirit of God really loud, and he was like, this is really inspiring. And he started talking, and then it's like, we'd like to welcome you to the visitor center. And, like, nobody can hear. And John's just, like, sitting there like, oh, my God.
Yeah. But it ended up, he was able to talk about most of his slides in his time allotment.
And everybody, he had a great response. It was a really good presentation.
Yeah.
And I would say the takeaway for me was, you know, sometimes I've heard the various branches of Mormonism described as cousins of Mormonism, but I was like, no, we're brothers of Mormonism. Yeah. Or with he said something actually at a dinner table that I was thinking about the entire time during his presentation. He said, all of the Mormon faith traditions really just have one prophet, and that's Joseph Smith. They all start with Joseph Smith. We don't realize, like, that all the other ones, you know, like...
They're like a leader. They're like a steward.
Right, but Joseph Smith was, like, the key figure behind all of it. He's the one he's kind of like the father of it, the way that maybe you could say Muhammad is the father of the Sunni and the Shia and or whatever else. It's...
The other thing, when I was in line with him kind of chatting as we were getting our food, and he said, we're working on training you guys to not say the church, but to say the LDS church, and distinguish that you're talking about the LDS church based in Salt Lake City, mm-hmm. and that Mormon means a lot more, and Lindsay Park talks about this a lot, that Mormon is not just LDS Mormons, that Mormon includes FLDS, it includes the Community of Christ, and all the different churches and groups, communities that have been formed from the Restoration Movement.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the key takeaways for me from this whole day.
The whole conference.
We're
not the only ones
right,
here.
Yeah,
you can either feel like... Yeah, I think that what you end up feeling is a solidarity with the other groups.
Yeah.
And just increased knowledge and familiarity with them. I've probably learned more today about the Community of Christ Church than I have, like, my entire life combined.
Yeah.
Put together, which is really, really enlightening.
Yeah.
Like I say about groups, when you don't know very much about a group, you think, oh, they're strange and weird, but then you learn about them, and you're like, oh, no, they're just like me in a lot of ways. And that exact thing happened with me today.
Yeah. So that was really awesome, and I want to actually get John Hammer. He's been on the podcast two or three times, I can't remember for sure, but he's been on before. I'm sure he'll come on again, and I'd like to get those slides up and available, because it was just a phenomenal presentation, putting the Restoration Movement in context. And
it'd be nice to
speaking about it fairly, but not just devotionally, but not critically in the sense of disparaging or saying, look how
invalidating
silly.
The whole experience,
right, yeah.
or the maybe mystical aspects.
Yeah,
or...
it was really, really a wonderful presentation. So I want to get that back on.
Despite technical difficulties.
Yeah. But Ziff from, how do you say it, Zalafa Heads, or, I don't know.
Ziff's a first one.
Zalafa Heads' daughter, Zalafa Lods.
Don't look at me.
Oh, dang it.
Sorry.
Ziff
Coach
is...
Key or whatever.
So he does it's that blog. You guys all know what blog I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but
Ziff.
He's done
Ziff.
Zalafa Heads' daughters.
He's done the analysis of the... You know, predicting the probability of the next prophet or whatever. And he puts actuarial table data in there. That one, that guy. So I ran into him and took a picture. And then Lindsay Park was out in the hall and I was talking with her and making sure we could release the recording of our presentation. She's like, yeah, that's fine. And I got chatting with her and totally missed the whole next presentation. But it was a lot of fun talking with Ziff and... Lindsay. So you said this last presentation might have been the cream of the crop.
I think as far as first of all, Sunstone has a lot of historical stuff, and so you kind of go there expecting some sort of theological or historical, but this was cognitive, psychological, neurological, physiological, and what I loved about it, the guy's name is...
Michael Ferguson.
Michael Ferguson. And him and his husband have been involved in sort of the oppositional lawsuits against conversion therapies, so they're doing a lot of wonderful advocacy work for those who are in that process of being in those... You know, they're making it illegal. So it's really... They're really neat guys. But the presentation was... He did not hold back... The lingo he was able to explain very, very dense and very, very complicated things in a way that was accessible without dumbing it down at all, I don't feel like.
Mm-hmm.
He used all of the lingo. It was a highly technical presentation at times, but it was very well stated and I guess we can kind of get into the context, the content, but he just, as far as like his presenting skills, he was a really engaging presenter and a very a fun guy to watch and listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And content-wise, he kind of talks just about, his presentation was about sort of like, the title of it is Seerstone's Absorptive Conscious States in Contemporary Mormon Practice.
Right. So he kind of organized it. The point he was trying to make is that the spiritual experiences that humans have are, to some extent, a physiological phenomenon that can be measured and analyzed scientifically, which is not a new conclusion. This is something that neuroscientists and scholars of religious experience have known for at least a good decade or two now. But he explained it really well for newbies who didn't know all that much about it. So he just began like really, really basic, just talking about how our brain releases hormones that regulate our perceptions and reactions to things, like the oxytocin chemical that promotes bonding and social interaction, that kind of thing. But also our body is constantly sending perceptions up to our brains that our mind then interprets and gives meanings to. And he just talked about how our minds, our default, he talked about the default state a lot,
mm-hmm.
how our brains have, through a variety of evolutionary processes, have adapted to function by putting meaning to things and creating stories and narratives to help explain the sensations that the brain perceives from the input that comes from the body. And that in the absence of something else, our brains automatically just switch into narrative-forming mode and story-forming mode to try to provide meaning to our experiences, which is really, really cool. And then he began to connect it to specifically like religious experiences and such.
And like, one other fascinating thing is it has, you know, a Mormon, you know, it's a Seerstones. So you initially think, oh, we're going to talk about the Mormon tradition quite a bit. But kind of, if you were to, like, take Mike Quinn and Maxine Hanks and his presentation and put them all together, they kind of talk about a similar thrust. And it's this idea that we feel like, because Mormonism seems so unique in the religious landscape, that Joseph Smith was sort of unusual, you know, he was able to produce this book and all that stuff. But, you know, as the presentation was going on, he was just talking about, like, all of these, the sort of trance type of things where you're going into visionary states or different things like that. Those are things that shamans do. Those are things that other cultures do. A lot of the things that are really special, like maybe feeling the spirit or accessing the ineffable, are things that other cultures have done in different ways. And so it kind of contextualizes that whole mystical experience that's in Mormonism. And that's a big part of Mormonism, you know, feeling the spirit or feeling God's presence within like all the entire religious tradition. So I thought that was really a really cool aspect of the presentation.
Right. And that was great. He talked about how, so he specifically talked about, are there ways that make it possible for our unconscious mind to be more accessible to us consciously? And he says mindfulness is a big one, hypnosis is another way, but then this trance phenomenon that he said academics haven't focused on all that much, but there's essentially a couple of key components to it, is that one, it turns off the way our brains perceive things under normal circumstances. Two, it activates in more intensity the parts of our brain that generate the stories and narratives, and that during these trance states that people like put shamans under the MRI machines and all this kind of stuff, they found that during these states, your brain mixes memories, perceptions to generate stories in new ways. So that's really cool. And then he combined it with, so how do anthropologists, how have they seen that this state gets induced throughout history? It says, one, by looking into flames or fires through rhythmic drummings, he says, or through looking at crystals and stones, or also through chemicals like peyote and that sort of stuff.
What about spinning? Did he talk about that?
No, but that would fit.
That's a, like,
that
a one Sufi
too. Yes,
thing.
Yes.
They spin and spin and spin.
Dervishes?
Yeah.
Right, yes.
Spinning
exactly.
Dervish. Whirling yep. Dervish.
Yep. Perfect. That's it. So, putting the dots together then, says, so the looking into certain types of crystals and stones has been able to induce a trance state, and when you're in a trance state, your brain mixes the things that are in your mind, memories, the things that your body's perceiving, to generate stories and narratives in a new way. So the suggestion with that was perhaps that's the scientific explanation of how Joseph's seer stones worked to produce the revelations and narratives and such that he produced, which I thought was an incredibly fascinating and profound way to think about just religious experience and phenomena and that sort of stuff.
And somebody asked, hey, what's with the hat then, you know? Or what's with the stone and the hat? And so he talked a little bit about how, and it was a lot of conjecture on his part, and he admitted that, but he said it could be that the sensory deprivation of darkness combined with, like, some sort of object that, you know, can help him get into this trance-like state that accessing his unconscious, those combined were what put him into the, sort of, the, like, this trance state. So, and he talked a little bit about meditation and how he meditates and some different methods of meditation that he used, which raised the question, you know, Ben and I are thinking, as we've sort of thought on the way here, as on our drive here, we were talking about this more mystical approach to Mormonism, because I think there is the context for that. So accessing the ineffable through meditation or through contemplation or pondering. So there'll be some interesting. I asked him a question and he said, "Yeah, let's talk." So there may be some discussions down the line, maybe a podcast in the works how to meditate through a Mormon context.
Yeah, that would be cool. And we've talked about that a little bit on the podcast. A couple episodes have had some of those things mentioned, especially the one with Sarah Collette and Mike Barker on the spiritual watering holes, I think is the thing that I've been using for the title. Anyway, so that was today, we talked with a lot of people, people that some knew the blog, others kind of did, and
everybody's been really cool.
Really positive.
We really like the people we've met. And
So tomorrow we'll have a devotional in the temple. Opening prayer by John Hamer. Actually, no, that's not true. Because he has to leave. John Hamer has to leave.
Maybe it'll be you, Brian.
Maybe it'll be me. Do they ever trust me?
No.
No.
We'll just look at everybody's aura, spirit, and whoever has the highest aura, they'll ask.
Ah.
Or the highest level of oxytocin.
Is he bringing his fMRI?
He is.
Test everyone.
Nobody's ready for prayer!
He'll just observe our chakra alignment. And
So Jana Reese is giving the sermon tomorrow, and like I think I might have said this already, and then Farrah Anderson Sneddon is giving the final talk on A History of Women's Healings. So
you only call it a talk if it's sacramental, Brian. It's a presentation.
On Sunday, a presentation. Good grief. Why do they call them TED Talks?
I don't know.
This is Sun Talks.
Yeah.
There we go.
So, to wrap up.
Sunstone was awesome. Oh, so in my talk with Lindsay, next month there's a Sunstone in Seattle. And early next year, January maybe, or maybe February, there's one in Berkeley, California, and then there's going to be one in Kirtland again, either at the end of March or the end of April. They haven't got that date nailed down. She wants to do it every year, so anyone in driving distance of Kirtland, look into around Easter. They're going to avoid General Conference, because obviously many Mormons are not going to be able to attend during General Conference.
Many LDS Mormons, that is.
But yeah, so that's on the calendar for the next year. So that's exciting.
Yeah, it was worth the registration fees and more.
Yeah. All right, well, that's Sunstone. There you go.
There we go.
All right.
So now we're going to go polish stones and find top hats to look into and see if we can have some
induced trance states.
Induced trance states and see what scriptures we can write out of it.
That's the takeaway I got from this whole thing.
Yeah. Got to write our own dang scripture.
Yeah.
All right, folks. It's been good talking, and this is the end.
Well, folks, there you go. That was the podcast freebie, I guess you could think of it, since it wasn't a regularly scheduled podcast. But this Saturday, we'll have an episode like we always do. Again, this will be with Ben Park, talking about another top 10 book in Mormon history, discussing Armin Moss's The Angel and the Beehive. So look forward to that. And until next time, keep keeping it weird.